I always think about my mother in December. This was her favorite month, and she died in this month. I still think she planned that. And she, I thought about this during the sit, so I just have to share it. It doesn't relate to anything, but she must be here around me because I can feel her everywhere. But she, you know, Christmas was a big deal for her, and she would put up stuff all over the whole house. Like at the beginning of December, I think if we could do it at Halloween, she would have started putting up Christmas stuff in Halloween, but my father was just not having that. So she'd put up all this Christmas stuff everywhere, and especially he had to put up lights all over the house. And she would whine and whine and whine until she got the lights up all over the house. So by the time I was a grown woman and moved back to Seattle, my father and mother got in a divorce, and I moved in with her to help kind of, you know, keep things together. And come December, she's like, "Are you putting up the lights?" I'm like, "No, I'm not putting up any lights." And she's crumbling because she needs these lights put up, and I won't do it. So we're driving somewhere, you know, it's so dark outside in Seattle. We're driving somewhere, and it's so dark. And she said, "Well, let's go look at the lights. You know, just go look." And I said, "No, we are not driving to look at lights. No, no, no." And she's very quiet in the car. My sister and I were in the car together. There's a group of us driving together. She's very quiet. And then all of a sudden she says, "Well, that's okay if you don't want people to think we're happy people." I was like, "Happy people? Where did that come from? There's like all this quiet." All of a sudden the whole car erupts into laughter. She said, "Only the happy people have lights on. If you don't put lights up, you're not happy during the Christmas season." So when I was walking here, all I noticed was all the lights all over the place, all these happy people. So if you don't have your lights up, I'm just telling you now, everybody knows you're not happy. So we're talking here about the paramis, and you know, I have some more stories that I want to share, because I said the last couple of weeks I've been noticing that living with the paramis requires that we talk about this in stories. Because I mean, we can talk about intellectually these paramis, but it doesn't matter how much you know them intellectually. You could list them off backwards, forwards, know all about them, but if in the midst of your everyday experience, they don't show up as real, felt sense, awakening support, then I don't know why we're doing this practice. I mean, that's the whole point, is to somehow or another practice in a way that we can awaken our mind and get some liberation from just the day-to-day difficulties of dealing with life. And so I have a story that I want to share. In my family, we call this the Great Fire. But I want to first tell you a little bit about my two boys so you understand who they are in this story. My oldest son, Raymond, very charismatic. You've heard stories about him. He's one of these very optimistic, wise kind of people. And he is vivacious and very... he's upbeat. I mean, he has his bad times, but he's one of those kind of people that it's in his optimism that we can find some kind of freedom or liberation or wisdom. Is this constant optimism that comes around all the time. But on the other hand, he takes big risks, very spontaneous and impulsive. And so a little edgy. And then the younger son, Thaddeus, is very quiet, very intimate, and engaging. So his wisdom comes from this up close, personal with you, that kind of wisdom. And but at the same time, he can also be a little bit too quiet and too isolated and alone. But when he's on, he's very much engaged and very much supportive in that way. And so I tell a lot of Raymond stories, right? I'm going to tell a Thaddeus story. This quieter, engineer-y type kid. So, and of course Raymond's in this story because, yeah. Anyway, so it's called The Grape Fire. Raymond would have been about 10, because Thaddeus was about 5 years old. And I am at home Saturday, lounging on the couch, doing nothing, watching TV, my favorite spot. And I get this knock on the door. So I go to the door, and there is Raymond and Thaddeus standing in the door. Like, I don't know why they're knocking on the door. They could have just came on in. So I ask them, why are you knocking on the door? What's going on? And Thaddeus commences to telling me, now, Mama, sometimes you know how Raymond is. And Raymond's got his head down, looking sad. And I'm like, what's going on? What happened? And Thaddeus continues that, you know, Raymond means good. He's trying to do the best that he can all the time in this advocacy kind of way. And I'm looking at Raymond. What did you do? What have you done? Raymond is looking all pitiful. And I'm getting more and more and more agitated because why would he need an advocate? That's the first thing. And then I hear the siren. I am looking at Raymond, what did you do? What did you do? And I'm very angry. And Thaddeus is like, Mama, we need to talk about this up front first. And I bolt past the boys and I'm running out of the house towards the siren. And Thaddeus is running behind me, this little five-year-old. Are you calm, Mama? Are you calm? And I'm like, no, I'm not calm. He's like, Mama, get calm. Work on being calm. You can't hear if you're not calm. And I'm just trying to run towards the siren. I have no idea where it's at. I'm frantic. I think some huge, terrible thing is happening. And Thaddeus is getting louder and louder. Mama, are you calm? That you can't understand if you don't get calm. Are you calm? And I'm like, no. And then he gets right in front of me. I'm almost going to fall over him. He goes, Mama, are you calm? Wait a moment. And I stop. Fine. I'm calm. He goes, okay. Now let me tell you what happened. And he takes me by the hand, and he's walking me towards this place where the fire is. But by now the siren's gone out and the fire trucks are all gone. And this is what he tells me what happened. He says him and Raymond were, it's a big giant median in the middle of this big road. Two sides, one way's on each side, and in the middle is this big median. It's like a park area, sort of like the way Beacon Avenue is. And except it has a little bit of a gully in it. And so him and Raymond were playing with matches. I should say Raymond was playing with matches and lit a little bit of leaves. And thought, oh, this is exciting. And he says, well, what do you think would happen if we put some more leaves on there? And of course, Thaddeus is like, I don't think that's a good idea, Raymond. I think we should just stick with the little patch of leaves here and watch them burn. But no, Raymond begins to put more leaves on and more leaves and more leaves. And before you know it, there's this fire. And I could see that I could feel this, that I was calmer and that what I would have done to Raymond in my agitated state is vastly different. And then Thaddeus says, you know, this was very upsetting to us, Mama. This is Waitos. This is Thaddeus, the engineer. This was very upsetting to us, Mama. And I think Raymond has learned a lesson. Have you learned your lesson, Raymond? Raymond's funny. He's all upset. And I actually thought in that moment that I had learned a lesson too. That by getting calm first, then my ability to be with whatever was going to come around the corner was far more manageable than it would have been if I had come around that corner and saw this, you know, just the fire, the burning, the fire trucks were leaving when we came around the corner. So I thought that would be a good story to start with in this whole idea of these paramis, because living with the paramis means necessarily that we have to live in the unknown. We can't live in this known world and be with these awakening practices, these practices that are going to take us into other places. There's a franticness that can happen about being in the unknown and a need to really, really narrow it down so I have some certainty, some surety, I know what's going on, and everything's going to be good, it's going to be safe, this way it's going to be. But if you hear some fire alarm, you're going to freak out wondering what is that and trying to fix it and going into really feeling into the paramis. We need to be able to be in the unknown, be willing to be part of the unknown. So think of it this way. We call insights, I'm assuming everybody in this room has had at least one insight, even if it was just, oh, the itch goes away if I don't scratch it. Simple. But not one of us would know that insight if it weren't for the unexpected nature of it. This unknowing is how these insights arise. An aha moment comes out of our unknowing, unexpected. Something happens that didn't follow our normal way of thinking, our normal expectation of what life is supposed to be like, and that not following it, that being able to see into the unknown is what makes an insight or these aha moments so beautiful, so wonderful, so keeping. So if our practice and the nature of the way we practice becomes bottled into this knowing, this is the way I do things, this is the way I live, and I'm just going to take a little bit of these paramis and put them in this already together life, then the awakening aspects of them we will not be able to see. We cannot awaken in the known, because if we could, we'd already be awakened. We already know it. But we cannot. So in order for us to go into the unknown, in order for us to be in the world of the unknown, we need two things. And that's what I want to talk about, these two things that we have to have, or we cannot go into this unknown world that is our practice. We can go into a known world by keeping our practice in the world we already know. But if we really want to go out there into what's possible with the paramis, what's possible with Dharma, then we need two more things. We need to go into travel into the unknown. So think of this as like having a Thaddeus. I think of the paramis as like Thaddeus, is what I realized. Like having a little Thaddeus. First, it's probably like a little, you know, whisper. Are you calm? Are you calm? Little whisper. Something's happening. You're frantic in this habitual momentum of energy. And there's a little thing that we've been working on all year. It's in you. It's already there. It's in there because the heart has heard it over the course of a year. So it's there, little whisper. Are you calm? Are you patient? Is that the truth? Where's your resolve here? Is there kindness here? What's happening here? There's a little bit of a whisper. But of course, we just ignore that whisper. It's okay, because it pokes us a little bit more. You can feel that kind of poking energy. Like that is running behind me constantly, poking at me to get calm. I can't understand. I can't hear what he's going to say. He can't explain it to me if I don't listen and get calm. Or sometimes you might have to have the Paramis stand right in front of you and yell at you, just a shouting, are you calm? Wait! Stop a moment. You can feel these Paramis when they're there. The unknown aspect of it is that in the midst of our momentum, our habitual way of being, in the midst of it, there's a thing that we hear, and it is stopping the known habit and moving into the unknown of that poking that's happening to us. That's what's unknown. Because the habit, doing things the way we want to do it and the doing things that we always do, how we do it, reacting, yelling, looking at Raymond, scolding him, all of that stuff is known. So we are looking for something that's unknown, and the only way you'll know what it is that there's a poking from the Paramis that's asking you, what's going on here? What's happening here? It stirs it up. And so you'll need to turn into that. And to turn into that is what we need, these two little pillars. Like if you go hiking and you go up on the really big hikes, you might need two poles. So I'm going to talk about the two poles, the two things you need. So the first thing you need is a faith. I call it faith, but I know that people have problems with that word, so think of it as trust or a conviction. I guess you could say a conviction in the unseen. I call it faith because it's a belief in something you don't know, you haven't seen. In Sharon Salzberg's book, I always love the way her title of that book, Faith, is trusting in your own experience. It's sort of that. It's a trust in something that you can't see and you don't know. And in fact, if you do know, you're not trusting in the awakening factor. The very nature of the awakening factor is trusting in something you don't know. Having a faith about your practice in the unknown of it. So what we are up against is a mind that believes in the surety of its own knowing. It believes this. It is convinced, and it convinces us that the more sure we are, the safer we're going to be, the more ease our life is going to be, more reliable life will be, and basically we're just going to be happier. So the whole premise of the mind's way of looking at life is the more surety I have in life, the more I know exactly what's going on, the better life's going to be. That's all there is to it. It's very simple. But it doesn't take long and a certain amount of practice before you begin to realize that this is not true. There is no safety in surety. Everything that we have talked about all year has been in relation to how to deal with the upheavals of life that's happening all the time. So the surety can't come from the stuff that we think is going to give us all the surety. We already have tried that, and it doesn't work. It's going to have to come from something else. And that something else is the weirdest thing in the world, but it is the mere fact it's unknown. That you begin to trust in the fact that you don't know, and that trust in the fact that you don't know is what creates the wisdom to want to know, to get interested, to recognize what we talked about the first week, the recognition, the wanting to look into it, and the ability to realize when you've had some awakening, some liberating insight. But you won't get that if you're not willing to look into the unknown, the thing that you don't know. So that's where it's at. So I want to tell you this story about, it's not related to Christmas. It's a Jewish holy day, but I'm not sure what holy day it is. I think it's around Passover. But this story is so profound to me. It is the essence of what I would think of as trusting in the unknown. I saw it on TV, I don't remember what show I was watching, but a man was given an interview, and part of his interview, he was sharing this story, and some people were acting out, you know, there was like a little reenactment of the story he was telling. He told the story, and there was this reenactment, and then he kind of came back and explained some things he learned. He was a grown man. This story happened when he was a kid. And so his family was trying to get out of Europe during the time of the Holocaust. And they were on this train. And they had gotten passes to tickets to get on the train to get out of Europe. But they were Jewish and they weren't supposed to travel. So there's all this trepidation, they're in a private car, and they had been traveling all day. He was describing how much there was ease in the room, and there was all this happiness, and it was just him, his mom, and his sister. I think he was about 7 years old or so, maybe a little older. Or he could have been even younger, but he was a kid. But he could remember distinctly what happened. So he was talking about how much fun they were having and how it felt like there was a sense of, we're going to be okay, we're going to get out of here, all this trepidation, we're going to leave it behind, everything's going to be great, and this kind of looking forward, giddy kind of way, he said. And then the sun went down, and his father begins to pull out all the Jewish sacred items to light these candles. And of course, his mother looks at her husband and says, "What are you doing? Don't do that." And his father just continues to get these things. And then him and his sister and his mom, they have this growing panic about if you light these candles, you are telling the world we are Jewish and we are going to have problems. So they are saying, "Don't do it." He even tells his dad, he says, "Don't do it, don't do it." And his dad looks at him and says, "Look, we are about to go into a world that we don't have a clue what it's going to be like. We don't know what it's going to be like. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't even know if it's better or worse than the world we're living. The only thing we do know is faith right here, right now. This moment right here, right now. And this moment right here, right now, we're lighting our candles. That's what we're going to do." So he lights the candles. They say their prayers. Everybody's kind of nervous. But they say their prayers. And he said he could remember feeling the sense of relief just in the saying of the prayers and the lighting of the candles, because they're still in the car by themselves. And then the train stops in the middle of nowhere. There's no lights, nothing except for the candle lights. And in bust these Nazis. They just come busting into the car. Oh my God, I'm so glad you're heaven sent. He says the lights went out, the electricity went out in the station. We can't see nothing. And thank God, here you are with the light sent by God. Scooch over. So they scoot all the people over and they sit right there and they start checking everybody's papers. And some of the people were Jewish and they got taken off the train. There's all this fear and all this trepidation. And the man and his wife and the kids sit right there. Jewish people go, the Nazis go through all their checking of papers and passes and they're all done. They get up and they say, thank you, thank you. You were a godsend. And they walk out the door. Never checked their papers, never looked. Train started back up and off they go. And the kid was now a grown man, said that that situation could have been different. He said, he realized that, right? But he said that the point was that that his father helped him realize that there are times when you don't know how a situation is going to end, you can't make it go a certain way. You don't know if it's going to be good or bad. You can't make it always be good. But that what he learned from his father was that it doesn't matter, good, bad, whatever's coming your way, it's your practice that you're going to put your trust and faith in. And it's the practice that you put your sense of surety in. Ever since I saw that thing, it completely blew my mind. I couldn't believe it. I never saw anything. I mean, I knew courage, but I decided, that's it. So every year, I would spend the whole year figuring out how I could come to a holy day with the boys and I that they would never forget. That somehow we had to create a holy day that was not about Santa Claus, that was not about the Easter Bunny, there was something about practice and being solid in practice. Nothing jovial about it, but serious that they would hold for the rest of their lives. The way that father had helped this kid hold something dear to him for the rest of his life. That's what I think we have to hold in the Dhamma. That degree of practice. Not this kind of overwhelming control of the rituals, but just the willingness to trust in the practice in the midst of the unknown, that it is the nature of the unknown that you are trying to have faith in, have courage in, and not fix it so that it's all tightly wound up and you know exactly what's going on. So the second story is this sense along the same line that we are not alone. We do not do this practice by ourselves. That this idea that somehow or another, this is my practice and I'm practicing with my meditation and that's it. Nobody else is around. It's just not true. And the Paramis is the perfect example of how it is that we cannot practice these things alone. So for instance, I thought about these Paramis, and I don't think any of these Paramis you can do by yourself. Meaning that you could be generous, but the nature of generosity is in the giving freely and in the accepting freely. That there's something about the giving and taking and generosity that makes that practice as opening as it is. And so we practice that together, both when we're generous, when we're not generous, our virtuous activities. I don't even know if virtue would mean anything if you're on an island by yourself with no other animals, no other people, even your virtue towards the earth. There's always a giving in your sense of not causing harm to another being or another living thing. That sense of virtue comes in the relationship of not causing harm, of goodwill. and this basic life of renunciation. So even in our renunciation, it's the support that we're giving to the rest of the world, that you can be safe with me, that you can be okay, that I can, you know, hold my own energy, whether it's craziness or some reactivity I have, I can restrain, I can hold my own energy and still be with each other. I can accept. I don't have to have everything go the way that I want it to go. Have just all my likes. I can be with some dislikes, and it's not the end of the world. I'm not going to go through all of them. You can think about it, but, you know, what does truthfulness have to do with anybody? I mean, I guess I can tell the truth to myself, but usually the truth that I'm telling is in relation to my world with other people and whether or not I'm being truthful to myself or to someone else. But the point that I want to help us see is that if we get too caught into thinking that we can practice this practice by myself, then it gets kind of hollow and it gets kind of rote, you know, you just kind of do it, go through the motions, but it doesn't have the aliveness. Because when we do this together with other people, you can see the unknown in it. You can see what happens if you give to someone and they don't seem to appreciate it. You can see what happens to you. You can tell. You can tell when you're not holding things okay, or if you don't have patience with other people, things like that. You can begin to see how the energies of these paramis are either weakening or strengthening inside you. That's why they're called the perfections, because we kind of tighten them up. We kind of notice who we are, where we are in the world, how we're moving through the world by how these paramis are coming in and out of our lives. So the story I want to share with you about is it's I don't even know if you could call this a story, but I really just want to share what this Sangha means to me. I think some of you may have remembered when I went to that retreat last year, that two-month retreat, and I just had this really, really difficult time because Rodney was leaving and I was scared to death, and I realized that I thought Sims would fall apart, and I was scared about that. But what was more important is the realization of what a Sangha is for me, having been raised in a black church. You know, we're gonna start our Sunday sit on Sunday mornings, and Tim and I were talking about it one time, and he goes, "Oh my God, Tori, I don't know what you're gonna do. You're gonna do the Sunday sit, and you know, your intensive practice classes on Sunday, and it's gonna be a lot." I almost busted out and started laughing. I said, "Tim, I grew up in the black church. We started going to church at 8 a.m. You were going to Sunday school at 8 a.m. By 10:30, you're doing devotion. 11 o'clock, you got 11 o'clock service. There's 3 o'clock service, sometimes a 5, but mostly a 7 o'clock service. So by the you leave the house at like 7 in the morning, and you get home like around 9 o'clock at night." I'm thinking, two things? What? That's nothing. But there's something about the black church that I wish we could experience in the communities that we have. And sometimes I feel it here at Sims, and it's so important and it's so necessary that without it, I just don't know how we get through difficult times like this. So if you think about it, I'm just going to tell you, from being black, it is crazy in the world around us. I mean, some of us spent a whole weekend with Reverend Angel, and it's crazy what black people have to go through. But don't even think about now. Think about all the crap we have gone through for years. And how do you think that we could have such a humbled, happy sense of well-being? How could I sit here as a black woman and have this sense of joy and happiness? And a lot of that is attributed to the practice, but the majority of it is attributed to my sense of connection to other people. I do not feel alone. And that sense of not feeling alone is what helps me when things seem like it's falling apart. And most of that came from growing up in a black church. That there was a sense, the music, the people, just the energy when you hit that door was so much, we're all in this together, whatever is going on, was so wrapped up in it that whatever you were experiencing when you left church, that is what you carried with you, was whatever you got in that church. I think that's why gospel music is so moving into the bones. So in some respects, we don't have that gospel music energy. But I don't know how we come to this sit and not feel each other's energy when we're sitting together. I've been in sits when I have walked in the room feeling in the dumps, and by the end of the sit, I am just full of energy, ready for anything. I probably would talk if we could just shout it out. But we don't. That energy isn't mine. It comes from being together. So I have this little thing I do. Whenever I have something difficult that seems too much for me to bear, I start this little circle around me. And I ask myself, I think of some people that I know in the practice and said, well, if we were all sitting here, could I hold it? If me and list some names of some friends of mine that are practitioners, no, I still couldn't hold it. Then I just expand that out. Well, what if I had all the Capitol Hill people and all of Sims, we were all sitting here holding it, could I do it? No, don't think I could hold it even if that. So then I go out, well, what if we had all the people in the United States holding this with me? Could I hold it? Sometimes I can. Sometimes I can't. Go out even further. What if all the teachers of my teachers were sitting here in this big circle and just keep widening and widening and widening until I had a sense that if the Buddha and all his disciples were all his students were around us. So think about it. There isn't a problem that anyone in this room or anyone that even listens to this tape, there is not a problem that anyone here has not, that we would experience that has not already been experienced by hundreds of people before us. There is no problem that's so big that the world or practitioners or all of us has not been through. There's no war, there's no famine, there's no tyranny, there's no nothing. No president, no Congress, no nothing, no laws, no nothing that hasn't been experienced by hundreds and hundreds of people before us. This practice, if you try to think of it as just you, then that means your limited little practice has to be able to hold whatever comes your way. But if you think of this practice for the power it actually has, which is 2,500 years of people sitting in stillness in difficult times, then all of a sudden you can begin to see the potential that we have together to hold whatever comes our way. I think that's what the paramis do. I think they are an ever-expanding, ever-opening practice. And the more and more and more open we want to get, the more and more and more open we'll get with the paramis. And the more open we get, the more widening our ability to take in whatever, the known and the unknown, the greater our capacity for a liberated mind. For a liberated mind, for a happy mind, for a gladdened mind, a peaceful mind. That's where I think the paramis are pointing to. So it doesn't matter where you get your sense of connection from. It could be from reading the suttas, listening to Dhamma talks. It could be from just practicing with a friend, practicing with a small group. It doesn't matter. Coming to Sims, it doesn't matter. What matters is that you never let yourself be disconnected from that sense of Sangha, that sense of community, that we are all doing this together. We probably should stop there. So, that's what I'm going to offer for our reflection. We'll sit quietly for a moment. Okay, so if somebody has any questions or comments, we got some time for that. I'm feeling pretty overwhelmed here. I don't know about you guys, but man. I don't know where that came from.
Huh. Hi, thank you. I was thinking when you said, you know, like if you practice alone, but then that's, we never practice alone.
Right.
And then, but we have language like in prayer, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. But, you know, if you change that to we, you again are bringing, you know, the world to you, or connecting a greater power than just, again, you know, grant me, or sitting there with me on the cushion. So I appreciate that you're pointing to that, but what I'm also seeing is that idea of this embracing that door we don't open, that unknown. And I catch myself all the time thinking about what I could do instead, especially working with children, when you're so tempted to, you know, stop, rather than, you know, and I liken it to saying yes. You know, that door of the unknown. It's like for me, I'm putting the word say yes. For me, that language helps me not turn away. And could you speak to how that could?
I think what you're so the first part is about the sense of aloneness. Even though we always say things like our prayers are directed towards me, you could shift the prayer towards we. But in relation to the me, there is a me. it's just that it's beginning to see that I am not me without everybody else. So it's not just, I mean, I may be asking for something personal for me, and I'm not saying that we don't have a sense of aloneness, that you can't, you have to always include we. I'm saying that there's a recognition that maybe it comes from my Christian upbringing, but there's a recognition that there's always Sangha with me. So even if I'm asking for my own courage to face the things that I cannot change, that ability to have that courage is coming from a recognition that I'm not by myself. That it's sort of like understanding that your ancestors are with you all the time. So that loneliness is not so much that you don't have to reference you, but it's this constant awareness that we are always with, that there are all these spirits and all these energies all around us. And I guess I like the idea of saying yes. I like the idea of saying yes to the unknown. I think that's what the paramis are. They're all yes things. And it's looking into whatever that difficulty is. Usually we have a difficulty because we're trying to square something up to be the way we're used to it being, to be the way we know. And it's not in the known right now. So we're trying to get it fixed so that it gets back into the known. And basically, the yes would be opening to both the known and the unknown. That possibility that I could actually be okay, even if I don't know what is going to happen, or even if I don't know if this is going to work or not, I could still be okay. Yeah?
Yeah, in a practical way, this is, you know, it really is all about how we are in the world with other people. Right?
Yeah.
That's why I came to this practice, because you can't be in a sangha if you hate yourself and you feel alone and you feel angry all the time and you feel hateful. You know, you're in sanghas at work and you do what you're supposed to do, you're in sanghas here and sanghas there, but you don't really participate because you can't. And I think that's where when the Buddha says, I take care of myself, and then I take care of everybody else. I'm finally starting to get that. I'm really only just learning some pyramids. I've been in the past. So just from a practical point, that's kind of, and from a real practical point, from generosity, I don't want to go into the story of it, but I'm once again being very generous to my sister.
Yeah.
And she is, and her response is, you know, you're not doing it right. there's no appreciation there. So, and I think I've got to the point now that I can, I get, like when I saw that this morning, I just got up, I walked back and forth for a little while, like, and then I, decided that the generosity belongs to me, it doesn't belong to her. The generosity is my passion. And I'm doing it because I want to. And when she comes next month, we're gonna do okay. I'm not gonna react to this stuff. And that's where, the generosity part and the being with, I think I'm rambling now.
Well, let me see if I can paraphrase a little bit that the comments just said, it seems practical that all of these paramis are about relationship, because that's the practical application of it. And so even what you're saying about generosity, doing it for yourself is beautiful. That's what these paramis are. We need to know about generosity. And we need to know about generosity by being in situations where we don't feel like we're generous enough, or we think we're too generous, or we feel like somebody's taking advantage of us. I mean, generosity is such a huge thing. If we're not in all these various situations, we won't know what generosity is. I mean, the mind thinks, oh, generosity is just giving something to somebody. But there's a whole world that happens in the giving. And so it's what it sounds like you're saying is you're speaking to whatever generosity is in the moment is fine. You said some, and excuse me? And your own reaction, that's it. I was going to say that you were worried about, you know, when your sister comes, you're not going to react, but you might react in ways you don't like. The point isn't so much that I won't react, but whether I react or I don't react, I'm going to be with that. I'm going to be with that, and I'm going to learn and try to see if I can be mindful to put the, you know, I look at it through my practice eyes and not through that judging eyes of the mind that can be so mean and miss the whole point. So instead, we're just going to look at it through practice eyes and say, oh, I see what I've learned here about whatever happens. Good. Can you guys feel the stillness in the room? It's so still here. It's about to bring me to tears. So beautiful. Yeah.
I liked how you're talking about armies poking. They poke. And I've noticed that in studying the paramis this year that they've been poking me. And my daughter's back visiting, and so I haven't seen her for a while. And in the very beginning, it's just, oh, you're back. It's great. And then I start to see some habitual things come back that were there from growing up, that were the known, you know, the way I react when this happens. And but I felt poke.
That's right.
I talked to her about it. Anyway, I changed. I mean, I didn't totally change, but I've been seeing this. Like, that wasn't very kind, or, you know, things like that. So the don't know, I like the really practical part of the don't know that, I'm going to have to do things that I don't know, that aren't comfortable, that aren't, you know, the first thing that comes around. But then there's a big don't know, which is the don't know that the mind can't know. There is something, and that's the faith thing.
That's right.
That there is a big don't know.
Don't know.
And when you were telling the story about the candle and all that, that's also true, and that's part of this.
Yes.
And so I really appreciated that story.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know how I'm going to, this was just a comment, so I'm just going to respond to the comment itself, that it really is, I mean, the paramis are such a gentle way to open into the don't know, because next year we're going to talk about the Four Noble Truths, and I think it's going to feel a little bit like we're going into the difficult side. But we'll need the paramis to stand on that, you know, this sense of moving into the openness of generosity, or moving into the equanimity in any given moment, moving into kindness, you know, in the midst of a feeling of just a tension there, you could just move into kindness. You don't even know what's going to happen if you move into kindness. And mostly we don't want to, because we think, oh no, I know, this is what I need to do. But it's the willingness to move into these unknown experiences, to apply the Dhamma just off of the fact that you have practiced this. Like you know it in your head, but you don't know what will happen if I try it. That larger don't know. I think that's what makes this practice so beautiful, so wonderful. Because when I think about the difference between me now in this practice and me before, it has to do with my ability to move into places I don't know what's going to happen. Before, I was a scaredy cat, pretty much. I was just scared and worried all the time. So everything had to be controlled. Everything had to, I had to know exactly how things were going to be, how they were going to look, what everybody was going to do, who was doing what. I mean, I had to have the whole thing like orchestrated out so I feel very secure. I know who's going to do what. And if anything happened outside of that, then my go-to energy was anger and intimidation. Fix it, get it back to the way everything is good now. And I'm all calmed down. That's probably why that is. It's like, calm down. You have to keep her calm. But now, I am exactly the same. I still have to control everything, and things got to go the way they need to go, and everything's got to be in its little thing. The difference is when it doesn't happen, and I feel all that tension, I can feel it, know it's there, and open to one of these paramis. So somehow we have this thought that the practice is going to make us better, but actually it's just going to keep us in the life we are. Whatever you think you are, you're going to stay that. It's not going to be some magic you. But it's the being okay with whoever I am and the recognizing that in the moment when you're being yourself, the parami helps you find the liberation in that self, in that whoever you are, that thing you do, there's a liberating aspect of it. It's not just the constricting aspect of it. And that's what I think you're pointing to, Lauren. It's this sense of, in the midst of being with your daughter, there's all this goodness and happiness, and then the old patterns start coming, and then we usually think the mind starts going into that, oh, there it goes again, that's the way it is. But the paramis poke us, so even when we see the habit, we can see the liberating nature of that habit. Like, oh, this is my opportunity to go beyond. But if you don't see the habit, and if you don't see the thing that's rubbing up against us, then we live our lives in habit all the time. It's only when we see them that we actually think, oh, something's new here. It's not. We live constantly in habit. And so mostly, we're living in habit and we're asleep. But every once in a while, we get this great opportunity to wake up because we see the habit and we see the difficulty of it. And the paramis is what pokes us to look a little deeper. So I'm going to stop because I'm going to go through some announcements. And I want to, so I want to share a little bit about the homework. It really is about looking at how sure you have to have your life. And whether over the next 2 weeks, we're going to see if we can, you know, consider what would it be like if life was not as controlled as we think it is. What would happen? What would we need in order to shake things up a bit? What would we need to keep our sense of steadiness in the midst of shaking things up? That's what we want to look at over the next 2 weeks and to see if the paramis would be the thing that would help us You know, if there are some things that we could do to help us. Because our lives are going to get shaken up over the next year. Who knows? I don't even know what's going to shake it up. But I just know it's going to be shaken up because it was shaken up last year. So we can pretty much bank and assume something's going to shake us up next year. So we want to think about what would I need in order for me to deal with that shaking up without having to spill it out all over everybody and everything around me. So next week we'll talk a little bit about, probably have some more stories and then talk about the implications about what all this means. Okay? Good?